The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
You are said in March that you would go to East Palestine, Ohio. You came here. How come you haven't gone to East Palestine yet?
Well, I haven't had the occasion to go to East Palestine. There's a lot going on here, and I just haven't been able to break. I was thinking whether I'd go to East Palestine this week, but I then was reminded I've got to go literally around the world.
He thought he was going to East Palestine this week, but then was reminded that he's, I guess, going around the world. New Delhi, the G20 summit. This, even when he lies in the most inconsequential ways, I mean, as far as inconsequential topics are concerned, but even when he does it, as you see there, he shows just how clueless he is, how fake this whole presidency is. How do you forget a round the world trip? And of course, he lies up front saying, well, yeah, I'm going to East Palestine this week, or I thought I was. And then he throws in that his aides told him that he's going to India and Vietnam and literally around the world. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. We had a live show yesterday on Labor Day, so if you missed that, you can get to it at our website. Just go to trumpetdaily.com. You can watch the live stream every weekday morning at 11 a.m. in the Central Time Zone of the United States. You can also get to the live video stream of this show at our Rumble channel. That's the Trumpet Daily. Just search for the Trumpet Daily, and then bookmark the page, and you can enjoy the live chat. And also, if you're at the Rumble page, as I am at this very moment, make sure that you give us the thumbs up and that you share the video as well. We rebroadcast this show, or at least LFA does for us, live from America TV. Every weekday evening at 8 p.m. in the Central Time Zone and 9 p.m. on the East Coast. If you want to email the show, td@thetrumpet.com. And don't forget about my Twitter handle. That's at Stephen Fleury, Stephen with a P-H. We're more active on Twitter than we used to be. Richard Palmer had a great Trumpet brief, or Trumpet morning brief, that went out today, just updating, giving a brief update on the push in southern Ukraine. I guess the Ukrainian forces have pushed through a Russian line of attack, and he says 50,000 casualties on both sides for Russia and Ukraine. And of course, over the weekend, you might have seen that Zelensky fired his defense minister. And then there was also the New York Times story wondering about where's all the money going. I mean, you talk about two corrupt nations. I mean, it is going to transform Europe, as Richard brought out in the brief. But these are two corrupt nations. And of course, the Biden crime family, they're in the thick of it with respect to Ukraine. And even the New York Times now is wondering, well, all this money that Ukraine is receiving, where is so much of it going? There's corruption charges even with respect to this defense minister, as I understand it. This is just coming back to Biden. Speaking of corruption, this is from the Wall Street Journal. It says Chinese nationals, sometimes posing as tourists, have accessed military bases and other sensitive sites in the U.S. as many as 100 times in recent years, according to U.S. officials who described the incidents as a potential espionage threat. All these Chinese nationals just in and out of U.S. bases. Nothing to see here. Says here the Defense Department, FBI and other agencies held a review last year to try to limit these incidents, which involve people whom officials have dubbed gate crashers because of their attempts, either by accident or intentionally, to get into U.S. military bases and other installations without proper authorization. General Flynn told us about that. I can't remember if that was on the air or just talking privately, but he mentioned this one spy, basically just how different it is. If they catch you over there in China spying for the U.S., well, you're going to go to the slammer for the rest of your life, or perhaps be executed. But here you just get a slap on the wrist like this. I mean, the feds probably don't have time to even track down these Chinese spies because they're too busy going after Jan Sixers. I saw another tweet just this morning. Poor guy from Arkansas, family man, small business owner, had his house raided by all of these FBI officials, and he's carted off to jail. Never mind his wife, never mind his children. He was at a January 6th protest. He just went, he didn't do anything to anyone. I told you about this yesterday on the show. I mean, the feds just rubbing their hands in glee. They got the Proud Boys. They're going behind bars for 18 years. For what? Well, they moved a barricade. That's terrorism. For 17 years. For what? Well, he stole a police barricade and smashed a window. Nobody advocates that kind of vandalism. But 17 years? There's murderers on the run that still haven't been tracked down. Guilty of federal crimes. And this is what your FBI is preoccupied with. Listen to this. Skip ahead, actually, to that, if I can find it. This is Kim Strassel at the Wall Street Journal. It says, it's the Justice Department's politicized Hunter Biden probe. So they go after protesters who show any kind of support for Donald Trump, and then these same agencies, they protect the Biden crime family. It says, Mr. Garland has worked hard to present Mr. Weiss as operating independently, but the record is showing that nearly every piece of justice, that's the Justice Department, its political appointees, its tax division, senior officials, the FBI, had fingers on the Weiss probe. Should anyone have any confidence that this will change now that Mr. Garland has bestowed on Mr. Weiss the honorific of special counsel? They'll just continue the cover-up. They'll continue the cover-up. Even as the nation goes up in flames, the talking heads were out in full force, including Joe Biden, over the weekend telling you just how wonderful the economy is, how the economy is booming. Did you know this? This is clip 5.
The U.S. economy is stronger than any other economy in the world right now, thanks to Joe Biden's leadership.
Well, I think people really aren't paying attention, honestly. And President Biden, regardless of how you feel about him, John, he has reindustrialized the United States of America. I don't care how you feel about Joe Biden. The record is clear on what he has done.
Earlier about how people are perceiving the economy. So when someone tells you Americans don't like Bidenomics, it's false. Americans approve of the components above 80%.
And today we have the strongest economy in the world. Replacing trickle-down economics with everyone on Wall Street is referring these days to Bidenomics. And guess what? It's working.
Strongest economy in the world, and Americans love it, say the millionaires on TV. All the millionaires, I mean, they couldn't be happier. This is from the LA Times over the weekend. Bidenomics just had its first birthday, and less than half the country celebrated. The president has to hope that that changes by the policy's second birthday next August, just weeks before the 2024 election. It says if more Americans aren't in a partying mood by then, neither will Democrats be on election night. It says, yet changing voters' minds when so many of them think this good economy is actually bad and getting worse is proving harder for President Biden than changing the $27 trillion economy itself. And Republicans aren't helping, of course. In other words, Republicans are out there lying, saying that we've got skyrocketing inflation and all these the costs for everything going up. We've just got to try to convince people that everything is great. So that's why they're out there doing what they're doing. That's why they're out there lying, telling you that everything's fantastic. The established rules are easy. If they say it's fantastic and wonderful, you know it's a disaster. And if they say it's a disaster, you know it's probably pretty good. This was Joe Biden down in the Florida trip, where he was asked, you know, are you going to go to Ohio at some point? But listen to him talking about his own roots as being just a middle class guy. Clip two.
Folks, all my time in public office, I've been referred to as middle class Joe. I guess they thought that was not very complimentary. Well, guess what? That's who I am.
Middle class Joe, the guy that's got homes all over the country. He just vacationed at his beach home in Delaware. One of the reporters asked him, you know, if he was vacationing. He said, no, I'm not vacationing. He vacations 40% of the time. And he says he's too busy. On the one hand, he says he's too busy to go to East Palestine. And then in the very same sentence, he says, I was going to go this week, but I forgot about that little round the world trip. Listen to Jesse Waters from last week, clip six.
The real power in Washington's not the politicians, it's the people behind the scenes. Fetterman's chief of staff is the real senator. Feinstein's aide tells her how to vote. We're being represented by people we didn't elect. These people claim they have our back, but they don't. We're at a place in history where the public's never had such a powerful voice. Yet, no one's listening to us. Self-appointed leaders instead seize on our screams, stand by our side, and then just walk home without lifting a finger.
Rule by bureaucrats, unelected bureaucrats, as he says there. And you can see why. I mean, someone with just a little bit of common sense can step back and say, okay, Donald Trump came forward representing the people, and the people absolutely loved it. They still do. That's why he's not declining in the polls. I'll get to that in just a second. This is an exchange, I think it was over at Fox Business. But listen to these two, and I'm sure they're probably more supportive of Trump than they are Biden. But just listen to this exchange, number three.
Look, I think former President Trump definitely has a grip on the smaller donors, and we've seen the smaller donors continue to be excited about the former president. The former president has a very strong grassroots base, and we have seen that demonstrated ever since the day after that Milwaukee debate that he was not at. We saw his mugshot be released from the Fulton County Jail, and you know, normally that would be not good for a politician. We've seen what mugshots have done to past politicians. It's not good. However, for former President Trump, he's raised millions of dollars off of that. It shows how he's been able to galvanize his base with this simple image, put it on merchandise, and make millions of dollars.
Right. Who would have thought a mugshot on a coffee mug would be a winning idea for a politician, huh?
So it's somewhat tongue-in-cheek, I realize, but the sharper analysis here would have been for these two to say the reason the mugshot is flying off the shelves is because ordinary Americans see that this is a DOJ and an FBI that's gone rogue. They don't see it as legitimate anymore. In normal times, yes, a mugshot would not be so good. A mugshot would not be a cash cow. But now it is. It says so much about where we are as a nation. It tells you everything you need to know about what's happened to Barack Obama's alphabet agencies. He's thoroughly weaponized all of them. And ordinary Americans see this. They understand what's happening. That's why his numbers keep going up. Listen to the regime media as they, in this case, they actually acknowledge that Donald Trump hasn't taken a hit because of these many indictments. Clip eight.
And be an outlier, but there have been a lot of polls that indicate that this, if it's a Trump-Biden rematch, this is going to be a close election. And again, that stupefies me. It should not be a close election. There is no way that any substantial portion of the electorate should support Donald Trump after we saw during what we saw during the 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency. You know, the man is an accused felon, 91 times or something like that, the total number of counts against him, yet for potentially 46% of Americans are willing to return him to the White House.
Despite the fact that Donald Trump is the first former president to have four indictments and a mugshot, he's still the man for Republicans.
And Georgia, as much as Donald Trump is probably still going to win the nomination there or the primary there.
He might have a weak campaign apparatus, Brendan, but with each indictment, Trump only grows his lead over the Republican field. Can anyone really stop him?
Well, no one's really trying to stop him. And that's what's so frustrating about this campaign. We don't really have much of a campaign here, to be honest. And I think that's what you're seeing. And even as Donald Trump is clearly the front runner here, nobody is really emerging as an alternative. Nobody is even acting like they want to take him on. Again, when nobody takes on the front runner is going to win. I mean, it's as simple as that. And it's pretty much, you know, in my view, too late for anything else to change at this point. And now he's going to have all of our attention for the months ahead, and nobody's going to be able to reclaim it. So, you know, nothing is over until it's over, but feels pretty over to me.
Right.
Owing to what has been said already about the impact that Trump has had on the party, in my view, Trumpism is on the ballot. Doesn't really matter which candidate emerges, whether it's Donald Trump or any other GOP candidate. Trumpism is on the ballot.
I mean, being indicted, that's making him stronger, raising $10 million, using an ugly mugshot to raise money. This is a movement. And anyone who thinks that you can apply the old political rules to trying to defeat this candidate based on he's scary, he's ugly, whatever you might want to call him, this is a movement. And we have to respect the fact that it's a movement.
They better get cracking now, because there's a real risk. And I can't believe I'm saying this. There's a risk that Donald Trump could return to the White House.
They just can't. They can't. They're stupefied. They're stupefied by the rise in his popularity. And there, Eugene Robinson, he said, I can't believe it. There's 91 counts against this man. 91 charges. And that's exactly the reason why, as I say, here's the sharper analysis. People are looking at this saying, 91 counts and nothing for Hunter or Joe or Hillary or Barack? 91 counts of what? Most people can't even name one. Moving boxes? So it's going to be neck and neck, they're saying. And of course, all of these polls are lopsided in the direction of never Trump. So if it's 46-46, you can be sure the bad orange man is leading comfortably, leaving aside the fact that they're going to try to cheat. You've got all these people now talking, well, the fake first lady, she's got the COVID after she got all the jabs. There was the guy on Fox, he's the resident Democrat. He's there saying, I got jabbed 7 times. And you're hearing these rumors coming from TSA and border security that we're going to have to tighten up on the masking here in the coming months. It's just like Donald Trump said, it's coming. Of course, it's coming as we head into a presidential election cycle. Are they really going to try the same thing? They pulled out all the stops in 2020. You got to give them credit for that. In any way that they could cheat, they cheated. But are they going to be able to cheat in exactly the same way right across the board, even together with another scamdemic? Well, we'll see what they try. We'll see what they try. But despite all of this, here's Donald Trump. He's still riding high. And yes, the mugshots, they're just flying off the shelves. Still though, you listen to the Never Trumpers, and there's so much wishful thinking. They still think there's time left for Nikki Haley to make a run. Tim Scott, Ron DeSantis, Mike Pence. Listen to this from The Architect, number 4.
37% are less likely to vote for Donald Trump because of the indictments. 24% say they're more likely. The more likely, that 24% are overwhelmingly Republican. The 37% are largely Democrat and significantly independent. But, you go into a general election with independents going against you strongly because of those indictments, that's a problem for the Republican nominee if it's Donald Trump. But these other cases are very serious and are going to present problems for the sitting president. What happens if he loses 16% or 20% of Republicans in 2024? He's dead at the polls in November, as is the GOP.
He's more pessimistic about Donald Trump's run than the people over at MSNBC. At least they're acknowledging. Eugene Robinson saying, I can't believe I'm saying this, but he could return to the White House. But there's Karl Rove. He's as never Trump as they can ever be. There he is saying that Trump is in danger. If he loses 16%, he's dead. He's dead. Can you believe that? It's pretty amazing. The lack of depth and sharpness to any of this commentary. The fact that they're so out of touch with just the ordinary American populace, the ordinary Americans, they have no clue. They can't understand it. Or they're wishfully hoping that Trump just loses another 16%. And then he's dead. He's completely dead. No chance. Just the news edit piece. Have you noticed how many more commentators, conservative, yes, but have you noticed how many of them are saying, yeah, this is Obama? I mean, I saw a headline just at Town Hall. I don't know if I have a quote from it, but with the latest ambassador appointment, Biden again proves it's Obama's third term. Where'd you hear about that? If you haven't subscribed to the Trumpet magazine, make sure you call the 800 number today. That's 1-866-930-3024. We'll give you a free one-year subscription to the Trumpet magazine so that you can have tomorrow's news, tomorrow's headlines today. Tomorrow's news today. That's what you get with the Trumpet magazine. Just the News says, in the final days of the Obama presidency, trusted aide Valerie Jarrett made a boast that has aged like spoiled milk. The president prides himself on the fact that his administration hasn't had a scandal and he hasn't done something to embarrass himself. Obama said that on the way out. And of course, he knew the regime media would run with it. Yeah, scandal free. I mean, that man has more scandals in his two terms in office than any other president in history. That's the truth of it. How far removed from the truth is the regime media to just take that spin and run with it? Scandal free. Obama never did anything embarrassing. There they were, the regime media, swooning. Even after 8 years, they're still swooning. Yeah, the economy's great. It's booming. Never been better. Why can't all Americans agree on this? The economy's fantastic. It says, ironically, the president that Jarrett would later go to work for, Joe Biden, has revealed a jaw-dropping pattern of secret emails with fake account names, weaponized the U.S. Department of Justice against political foes, and entanglement with tens of millions of dollars in foreign money and other ethical conflicts. It says here, the new evidence and contradictory statements from Biden about his tenure as vice president, Obama was the president, keep in mind, has created a new question for congressional investigators. What did Barack Obama know, and when did he know it? Of course Obama knew. It says, I think that one question I have is, I wonder what President Obama knew about his vice president's corrupt business schemes with his son. That's a quote from James Comer. They go on and quote Newt Gingrich. We gave you that soundbite yesterday or the day before. Says here, all of this is occurring while Obama's president, Gingrich told John Solomon. None of this could have happened without his active knowledge, Gingrich said. It's just not possible. So what you have is Obama weaponizing the Justice Department, breaking down the rule of law, establishing a defense for any left-winger who wants to be corrupt, and at the same time, using the government to launch attacks on Donald Trump because they're so frightened of him. This is the administration, and it's ongoing. This is Obama's third term. And the regime says, never a scandal. Never once. Never once did he embarrass himself. It says here, it is unclear whether, if subpoenaed, that former President Obama will respond, let alone testify about Biden or Hillary Clinton's money-making schemes. How, even in the House, how has Barack Obama not been subpoenaed? Or Hunter Biden? They're not even investigated. Like I say, you couldn't be farther removed from reality. To hear from Valerie Jarrett, you know, this president, he's proud of the fact that there just hasn't been any scandals, and the media just writing it down on their notepad. Scandal-free, okay, scandal-free, right? He never embarrassed himself, okay, we got the marching orders. Look at how much has been revealed. At least, as I say, at least there's some conservative commentators coming out with these kinds of headlines. This also is from Town Hall. Why Barack Obama is probably supremely annoyed with Joe Biden right now. I had to read this paragraph a couple times because of what it says about Obama. It says, with this bribery scandal tying a noose around the necks of the Biden family, Obama is probably frustrated now that it's been revealed that Joe was using fake names in numerous emails, some of which discussed matters relating to his son's influence peddling to foreign officials and oligarchs while serving as his vice president. It says the National Archives has these communications and Obama must decide in roughly a month whether to release these emails. Obama must decide. It just says it in passing, as if it's common knowledge that Obama controls the National Archives, that Obama controls these federal agencies. It's certainly not Joe Biden. He forgot about his round the world trip this week. Obama must decide. And then the Katie Pavlich one, why the latest ambassador appointment to Israel proves this is Obama's third term. Who did Obama appoint? A guy by the name of Jack Lew. He was one of the architects for the worst foreign policy disaster in the history of the United States. That's the way my father described it. The Iran nuclear deal. So an Israeli ambassador or an ambassador to Israel, he resigns, and then this is who's appointed to replace him. An Obama guy, of course. The next issue of The Trumpet, by the way, this is the January issue from earlier this year. The October issue coming out, I saw a draft, so maybe the cover or the title will change a little bit, but it has a shot of the dear leader, and it's under the headline, Who's Running the Show? Who's running the show at the White House? As I say, you've heard this before if you're a regular reader of the Trumpet magazine. Get on the phone and call our operators, 1-866-930-3024, to shift gears ever so slightly, or maybe more abruptly. You might have seen this. Well, I'll let you hear what this woman has to say. She's basically, you know, pushing 30, and she's so happy that she just hasn't gotten married and hasn't had children. All these burdens that would she'd have to get up early on a Saturday morning, and you can't have that. So here she is on Saturday morning, having just gotten out of bed, and she feels it's so important to play this particular clip on her. Whatever, I guess it was her TikTok page, clip 7.
It's 10:45 a.m. on a Saturday. I am 29 and single, and I don't have kids yet. Here's what your Saturday morning looks like when you're single at 29 and you don't have a kid running around the house. I didn't rise from my bed until 10:15. Every time I thought, I should probably get up and do something, I thought, why? Nobody's making me. I'm not missing out on anything. I went to Beyonce last night and I didn't get home until 1 a.m. And I danced and drank my little heart out. And I didn't pay a babysitter to watch my kids as I did that. And I woke up a tad hungover this morning, which is probably why I was in bed for so long. And I was just scrolling on my phone and I saw a picture of shakshuka and I thought, you know what sounds really good? Maybe I'm gonna learn how to make shakshuka today. Because I have no plans and I don't have kids and I don't have a husband and I don't have errands to run.
I don't have responsibilities. And I can't believe how self-absorbed I am. She's bragging about this. You feel sorry for her. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being single if you haven't found someone yet. But to celebrate that lifestyle, no wonder there's so many people in this world just completely miserable. They're just completely absorbed in themselves. Radical individualism. Just do what you want to do and forget about responsibility. I guess forget about a job. Forget about a high level or standard of morality. Forget all that. Just do what you want to do. Do what feels good. Do what feels right. There's a way that seems right, but the end thereof are the ways of death or leads to death. That's what Proverbs 14:12 has to say. This is from The Atlantic. It says, the chart comes from, it's a study, why married people are happier. It says, the chart comes from a recent paper by Sam Peltzman, an emeritus economics professor at the University of Chicago, for the study, it says, which has not been not yet been peer-reviewed. Peltzman looked at the general social survey, which since 1972 has asked thousands of Americans, taken all together, how would you say things are these days? Would you say that you are very happy, pretty happy, or not too happy? If you imagine this large sample as 100 people, historically about 50 of those people say they're pretty happy, and that's still true. But in the 1970s, about 35 people would say they're very happy, and 15 would say not too happy. That began to shift around 2000, and now about 32 people say they're very happy. Well, further on, let me just say, or cut to the chase here. It says, after slicing the demographic data every which way, income, education level, race, location, age, gender, Peltzman found that this happiness dip is mainly attributable to one thing. Married people are happier, and Americans aren't getting married as much. So there's a trend overall of people becoming more and more unhappy. And why? Well, because the same trend is there for marriage. You think about Herbert Armstrong's booklet, Why Marriage? Soon Obsolete, he asked. Is marriage on the way down and out? He was asking that back in the 1960s. Here again, you talk about tomorrow's news today. You see that all through our literature library. If you don't have a copy of that booklet, that in some ways, in a good way, it'll make your head explode as you get a snapshot of God's master plan and how that it all revolves around marriage and family. So of course the devil's going to come with this message that, well, I'm single and I'm so much happier because I can just be so selfish. Very, very sad indeed. One final one. This is from The Sun over in the UK. It says, startling recent figures from communications regulator Ofcom show that 20% of kids have a smartphone by the age of three. Three. And that rises to 55% between the ages of 8 to 11. But the residents of one seaside town in Ireland have decided they do not want their little ones to spend their most formative years peering into a tiny LCD screen. So the whole town got behind this and basically banned phones, smartphones, among the young people. And guess what? It survived. It's okay. Life goes on. These kids are probably outside playing more, actually socializing with people face to face instead of staring at a screen. Like I say, whether it's any topic, as I say, with respect to next year's election or these stories, I mean, you think about the church, God's family, the position we have on any given topic, the reason there's so much soundness and common sense in it is because it's just based on the Bible. That's why. It's based on God's truth. People want to reject the Bible. And God says every word of it's inspired. We want to build our lives on this foundation of righteousness and seeking first the kingdom of God. Building families for God. We've been really emphasizing that in the marriage and family course. I'll have a class for that here right after this show is over. Tuesdays and Thursdays. And we lock in. And we think about God's master plan. And then how that we, even in this physical realm, ought to build marriages and families for God. You are listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Don't forget the email address if you want to send some feedback, td@thetrumpet.com. And also, don't forget about the Twitter handle. That's @StephenFleury, or I guess the X handle. Whether it's Twitter or X, it's @StephenFleury. Also, remember the evening rebroadcast of this show. That's at LFA TV over on Rumble. We'll be right back.
Is marriage on the way out? Is the institution of the home, with its family life, to disappear from society? How and when did the institution of marriage originate? Does it, after all, serve any necessary purpose? Why Marriage, Soon Obsolete, takes an in-depth look at the institutions of marriage, the home and family life, and reveals a startling, even shocking truth, which has been altogether overlooked by science, by religion, by education, and by society. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
This summer, Sam and I were able to visit. It was one our when we went up to see the show in, I think it was Delaware, and then had the Celtic Throne, or rather the PAC, the Public Appearance Campaign, in Wilmington, I believe. But we had a little time in the afternoon after the show to drive up the highway for a ways and visit Valley Forge, which was really an inspiring visit. Most Americans, perhaps not as much as they used to, I suppose, but most Americans know a little bit about the history associated with that valley in eastern Pennsylvania. It was late 1777. The British forces had been pushing hard against Washington's troops, and they occupied Philadelphia at that time. And ahead of that occupation, that was where the Continental Congress was situated, in Philadelphia. So you had all of these politicians and leaders that had to flee the city. And then Washington's troops settled into Valley Forge for what would be a brutal winter. And they were going to be there for months. And it was following quite a few significant losses and retreats, even one at Brandywine Creek that's nearby Valley Forge. And so they settled into Valley Forge. I think it was like a day's trip from Philadelphia. So Washington, George Washington, he wanted to be close enough to Philadelphia to where he could sort of keep his eye on the British troops' movements, but yet also get some additional training. And they did a lot of building that winter. They were really short on supplies and even funding, and a lot of people went AWOL. But it was George Washington who basically kept the army intact. He had this this Prussian general, his name was von Steuben, who came in and trained the troops. So that proved to be valuable for the U.S. Army going forward. But it was a difficult winter. Lots of sickness, influenza and typhoid fever. That killed off 2,000 of George Washington's men. This young private, his name was Martin, he said, "We're now in a truly forlorn condition. No clothing, no provision, and as disheartened as can be." They really had to make a lot of sacrifices. I think the most inspiring thing about that visit for me was visiting George Washington's headquarters. It was just a tiny little farmhouse, like basically the size of one wing of my home. Not very big at all. And that was where he had his headquarters, and it's also where he slept along with about 20 other people, some of his officers and so on. So they were just crammed into this tiny little farmhouse. And that was the best accommodation that the army had. That was for George Washington. It says here from the book Valley Forge, speaking of some of his officers, his assistants. It says here, the 19-year-old Marquis de Lafayette was given the honor of riding beside Washington, hard on the duo's heels, in their own long officers' coats, boots shined to a luster and spurs jangling, came the indispensable polymath Alexander Hamilton, who at 22, so Lafayette was 19, Hamilton was 22, mentions another guy here, John Lawrence, who was 22. That's one thing that you see in that book, Valley Forge. It's by Bob Drury. But you can also see it with just a simple search on Google. Just how many, Washington must have been in his 40s at this time. I'm not exactly sure on his age, but he was surrounded by a lot of young people who were living in Valley Forge for that brutal winter, making sacrifices for what would become the United States of America. Notice what it says in 2 Timothy 2. You can obviously see some pretty powerful spiritual lessons here. In fact, we've had with the General Flynn visit, and my father opening orientation basically for this school year, talking about how that we need to be spiritual warriors, setting epic goals, being willing to fight for God. And then a week later, we're able to draw on all these lessons and experiences that General Michael Flynn has learned over the course of his long and productive life in serving his country for nearly three decades, or a little over, I think it is. There's lots that can be learned from lessons on the battlefield. Paul says here in 2 Timothy 2:1, "You therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things that you have heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit you to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also." It's important for us to be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus, to be filled with the power of God. Stand against the wiles of the devil, it says over in Ephesians 6. We've got to be willing to stand firm. The devil is relentless. He's never going to stop attacking. Verse 3, it says, "You therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ." God has called us into a great spiritual war, and his charge, his admonition, is for us to endure hardness and to be a good soldier. You think about a soldier's life, at least being one of those soldiers at Valley Forge in the winter of 1777 and 78, that would not have been easy. I mean, you were in danger of dying just from the typhoid. It says in verse 4, "No man that wars entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who has chosen him to be a soldier." Is that the way that you see your calling as part of God's family? The fact that you've been chosen or selected to be a good soldier? Verse 5 says, "And if a man also strive for masteries, yet is he not crowned except he strive lawfully." So we've got to stay within the bounds of God's laws. God's given us the guidebook for living right here in the Holy Bible. And the only thing that makes this valuable or makes this useful is if we put it into practice. Otherwise, it's just a book sitting on a table, a book sitting on a shelf. But if we use these words, if we live by every word, as Jesus said in Matthew 4, if we strive to become perfect, like our Father in heaven is perfect, Matthew 5, 48, well, then you see quite the transformation. God actually taking a lump of clay and transforming it into a God being, a family member, born again. That's in John 3. That's another inspiring study that you can go through with the help of the late Herbert Armstrong. Just what do you mean, born again? It's a wonderful little booklet. But just to come back to these examples, Valley Forge and some of the positive things that were happening, they were busy. They were building little cabins to try to protect themselves from the elements. They got some additional military training, which they needed. They were able to kind of catch their breath before they would then go and pursue the British troops after they did leave Philadelphia. But one lesson that we can take away from this history is just how important it is to build on a solid foundation. This in many ways is how the United States of America was built, how it became established. Were it not for George Washington's ragtag army, there would be no United States of America. We wouldn't exist. I mean, they weren't even getting a lot of support from the local farmers around Valley Forge because they wanted to go to Philadelphia and sell their goods at top price to British soldiers. And so many of them had more resources. They certainly had more in the way of provisions and clothing and that sort of thing. But a lot of those farmers, they didn't want to make sacrifices for Washington's army because they didn't get as much in return. There were certainly some who were patriots, but you know, there were a lot of British sympathizers all through the United States at that time. So they were going up against a lot, but happy for them, Washington was like a rock. He was solid. and the troops did rally around him. How important is it for us to build on a strong foundation? What happened in Valley Forge in the winter of 77 and 78, that really became the foundation of what would later be, well, not just the United States Army, but as I said, the United States itself. That was the foundation. Proverbs 18, just to give you a quote from an article my father wrote back in 2013, it says, Herbert W. Armstrong also came from a strong family and had a strong marriage. He taught us that the foundation of a college is Malachi 4, 5, and 6. I'll leave it to you to read those two verses at the end of Malachi. That's the family foundation that we need. There's no shame, as I said in the first segment, there's no shame in being single. But as I tell our students all the time, I mean, yeah, we date widely when you're in the college sphere. You don't draw near to someone in the marriage sense until it's time. Ecclesiastes 3 talks about the season for love and the season for refraining from an embrace. But we're educating our young people through classes like Principles of Living, like Marriage and Family, to prepare them for life, to prepare them for how to live, how to make a marriage work. That, like you saw in that study, I mean, these are people that don't even know the purpose for marriage and family, the purpose behind it. And yet still they're acknowledging, or they're finding in that study, that people who are married physically are happier. How much more happy will we be if we really understand why marriage? Why family? This is from a 2009 article. It's important that the instructors and students get to know each other. So we really do preach. You come into this campus environment and automatically you're coming into a family operation. There's family all around in the spiritual sense, God's family, God's church. And then they receive that special training. They receive the special training, our students, and then they prepare. I mean, still, Satan is very subtle and powerful. And even with knowing what we know, we're going to come under attack. But how much better is it to really be prepared for marriage and family and to build a strong foundation for that family living? Proverbs 18 and verse 24 says, a man that has friends must show himself friendly, and there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. A man that has lots of friends in the family, he must show himself to be friendly. So as part of the program here at AC, young people come in and we preach date widely, date as many different people as possible, and make it wholesome and uplifting, and hold to a high moral standard. Get to know as many people as possible. Show yourself to be friendly. Build up the spiritual family of God first. And then when the season is right, and when you're of the right age, and you've been counseled properly and prepared for it, then marry and build a family. This is the foundation of the church. Mr. Armstrong used to say that the foundation of any strong and stable society, it's the marriages and the families. We need those. We need those in the church. We need those in our society. Look at what's happening to our nations. Marriage is on the decline, as I covered in the first segment. And so is happiness. Well, how about that? How many people, though, are going to be making any kind of connection there? There's a movement in our nations that's actively working to destroy family, to conspire against fatherhood, to twist and distort the thinking of young women, and well, old women as well, just like you saw in that clip, that 29-year-old. Another lesson that you can take away from some of that history, the founding of this nation, the founding of the United States Army, is to be goal-oriented, to be goal-oriented. My father said at the orientation for the college that we ought to set epic goals. He used the example of Winston Churchill, how that when he was off and stationed in India. He set a goal of reading, I think it was 50 pages of Macaulay every day, and then 25 pages of Gibbon, I believe. I mean, that's not easy reading, but he did set epic goals, and he was specific, and probably wrote them down. There's a proverb that says, where there's no vision, the people perish. I mean, we need to see where we're going. We need to have a good idea of what's ahead, what's on the horizon. This is from Thomas Flexner's book on Washington. It says, Washington tried to prepare his mind for a mass desertion or even the mutiny of unpaid, unfed, naked troops suffering to protect fat civilians who either criticized or ignored them. Again, these were dire conditions. And Washington was prepared for the worst. He wanted to be ready, just in case. It says here, naked and starving as they are, this is quoting Washington, we cannot enough admire the incomparable patience and fidelity of the soldiery. He praised his men, even in the midst of these dire conditions. It says here, the ragged varlets on their bleak hillside relished such sentiments from their general because they knew that he truly believed in them himself and that he every day did his best to live up to his ideals. Every day he was leading from the front. He had an objective. He had goals. He knew what the mission was. Mr. Armstrong talked about how important it is to be goal-oriented in his booklet, Seven Laws of Success. There's another one. That's quite a whopper as well. We've covered a lot of Mr. Armstrong's booklets today. The Why Marriage book, fantastic. Fantastic little booklet. Same with the Seven Laws of Success. In fact, you leave aside the United States and Britain and Prophecy, and I believe the most popular booklet that he ever produced is Seven Laws of Success. Says here, and so, if you are to arrive at success in life, you must first set the right goal, and then comes the preparation to achieve the goal. It says, so the second law of success in time sequence is education or preparation. But we have to learn to study, to be educated, to be prepared for what we propose to do. So the first law, there you see the book. The first law of success is to set the right goal. And then following that, you've got to go out and produce. Be educated. Be trained. Get the instruction you need. I'll leave it to you to study that booklet if you're hanging on in suspense about what the other laws of success are. Make sure you order your free copy of Seven Laws of Success today. In so many of his writings, Mr. Armstrong talked about how that so many people are just victims of circumstance. It's just like that young woman that's, you know, she's out partying. She's going to a concert. She can sleep in as long as she wants. She can decide to live a more productive life. Hopefully someday she will. But the lifestyle that's celebrated today, no goals, don't bother educating yourself. Just be woke. You'll do fine. There's another way, a better way, a more excellent way, as it says in 1 Corinthians 12. And that way is described in God's Word. Speaking of study and education, study to show yourself approved unto God. Study God's Word first and foremost. We have run out of time. Goes by so fast. The email address, td@thetrumpet.com, the Twitter handle @StephenFlurry, Stephen with a PH. And also, if you're over at Rumble, make sure that you give us the thumbs up so that our standing on Rumble can continue to rise. You are listening to Stephen Flurry, and this is The Trumpet Daily. We thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.